Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is David Greenberger. David Greenberger has been a real estate attorney for over 25 years, helping clients with thousands of transactions to buy, sell, refinance, and manage real estate. He has owned an escrow firm and is president of the 1031 Exchange Advantage, Inc., a 1031 exchange accommodator for facilitating tax-free exchanges under the IRS Section 1031 code. David's quite familiar with many of the management, tax, accounting, and transactional issues surrounding residential and investment real estate. Some of his clients include Prudential California, the largest broker in the United States, and Prudential Douglas Elliman in New York. David's articles have appeared in the New York Real Estate Journal, Lore Magazine, and Creative Real Estate Magazine. He has appeared on the cable television show Creative Real Estate Roundtable on numerous occasions. David, welcome back.
Thank you.
We were talking a little bit about time frame, so let's just nail down that for people that maybe get involved in that. There's two segments of time. There's a 45-day time period where I've got to find and name that replacement property, and then 180 days to close that replacement property. That 180 days is not plus 45. That 45 days is within that 180.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right. Both time frames start at the same gun, and the gun goes off based on the date on the HUD-1 or the closing statement. So if you're ever audited, that's the first thing they're going to look for is the closing statement on your sale, closing statement on your replacement property, your ID, your exchange agreement, and there you go.
Is there ever a time where the 180 days is less than 180 days?
Well, good question. Depending on the time of the year,
exactly.
The law says 180 days or when you file your next return. So at the end of November and December, when you start these exchanges, most people file their return April 15. So if you started in November, you'd have 6 months roughly. So you have December, January, February, March, April. But you know your April 15 date is going to run up and be less than 180 days if your exchange is started in mid-November on out to December 31st.
Yeah, so I mean, now, could it be? It could be a much shorter time unless you do something.
A much shorter time, yeah. But you can always extend and get back to 180 days if you file an extension on your tax return.
Right.
So that's the way to get around that. One other thing that comes to mind, if you don't mind, about time frames and dates at the end of the year. A lot of people are wise to consider starting an exchange, even if it's a regular sale that you have no intention of exchanging. But if you're beginning, if your sale is closing towards the end of the year, what you can do is set up the sale as an exchange. And when the escrow closes, the money goes to the accommodator. Well, sit with the accommodator until January 1 of the following year. If you cancel that exchange January 1 in the next year, your taxes that relate to the gain are pushed over to the following year. So, you know, you're not going to defer the taxes indefinitely, but you're going to be able to get an extra year to pay those taxes that relate to the gain. Not the debt relief, that's still due in the prior year when you sold, but the taxes relating to the gain and the cash that you receive in the following year are taxed in the following year. So it's kind of a little...
Well, maybe not a little. That could be a big deal.
Well, we send out emails till the end of the year, you know, trying to tell people about doing that.
Okay. That's a new one. I didn't know that. Let's say I did my best. I got three properties named, and it just didn't happen. I didn't close any of those, but I did find one I really liked, and so I said, "Gosh, if we could just date that back to when we had it before." So, like, what can we put it inside that 45-day time period? I'm sure you might have had that suggested to you at a time or two. What are the
on occasion?
What are the ramifications of doing that?
If not too good if somebody finds out.
Exactly.
It's not legal. Yeah. And backdating a document, you know, might even have a jail sentence next to Martha Stewart somewhere. I don't know if that's too advisable, because I don't think, you know, it would be. You're supposed to put an identification on the record to either the accommodator or a fiduciary. You do not need to identify only to your accommodator. You can identify to another third party that falls into the requirements, which would be a fiduciary, like a accountant, attorney, a broker, so forth. But you are supposed to do it within 45 days of the close of escrow on your relinquished.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately for the internet, you know, you can just type up anything you want and get a thousand choices. But there was no shortage of stories about people that had fudged on some form of date for an exchange and suffered the penalty of either jail or a huge penalty on the tax that they had.
Well, you don't want to add insult to injury.
Yeah.
The tax is bad enough. You don't need a penalty.
That is true. But you also don't need jail. The accommodator goes along with something like that, is that a big problem for them as well?
I'm sure that's not seen too well.
Yeah. Is this a very rare suggestion by people?
I wouldn't say they suggest. I would say they do ask whether or not there's a way around that kind of thing. But in essence, you know, they understand that there are rules.
The group of investors, you know, just in general, they're creative. I mean, that you got to give them that. They are creative. How they do things other people don't. And I just think that this is one of those areas where creativity is really dangerous. So that's kind of why I was bringing it up, because it's second nature to them. It's just like, what's the big deal? We just change this or whatever. Yeah, in this category where the IRS can come take a look at your stuff, and it's pretty easy to say that wasn't there. That's
a
problem.
That's right. Now, we've had people try to transfer out to another accommodator. And that's kind of a gray area, too. But, yeah, they do get creative. That's short, long and short of it.
What's the odds of a file being audited, and what red flags one?
Well, see, that's an interesting question, because I've been to a lot of the Federation of Exchange Accommodator meetings, and they always ask that question, or a similar question, you know, how many people have clients that have been audited, and what brought it upon them, and do you think the exchange, or the fact they were doing an exchange, had anything to do with it? And everybody, really, 99% of the time, says absolutely not. Of those that are audited, the exchange had nothing to do with it. An audit is triggered by a lot of different things, a lot of which are random. I mean, I was audited, a quick funny story, and I was audited because there was an inconsistency with the way that the exchange balances were reported one year versus another. And we got different, you know, tax advice as to how to report it, and when we made that change, that randomly triggered an audit. Well, the auditor came in. He was all of 26 years old, and I don't think he was on too many audits. And we turned out to be clean as a whistle, and there was no problem. But the funny thing is, he actually said to me the first day I met him, Mr. Greenberger, what is a 1031 exchange? So I said, well, you know, this is your rule. Don't you have any familiar? Anyway, at the end of the audit, he came back to me and said, well, you know, I got to tell you, I read a lot on your website, and I did learn a lot about an exchange, and thank you very much.
Yeah. I'm sure you've been interviewed by people that you realize that they don't know the subject matter well enough to understand the answers you're giving, and that's
they don't know what they don't know, and they don't know what to ask, and
yeah,
so forth and so on.
There's a designation that I earned one time by accident, and I became a dealer. I got audited by the IRS at the time. I just didn't have professional people around me. I was buying and selling properties under my own name. And I had bought properties in maybe 25 that year and sold them. And I got audited. And the guy, he looked at the amount I did. And he says, man, you do a lot of this. He says, you must be a dealer. And I thought he was complimenting me. And I said, yeah. And it took a little while for me to realize that was a bad designation. If I'm declared a dealer, is 1031 exchange even is it an option for me?
No, it's not. And being the Class dealer is kind of a gray area as to when that happens and when it doesn't, as it is a speculator, which is similar in some respects. But, dealers are not allowed to exchange because they're in the business. Exchanges is only for investors and not speculators. The only true definition of a speculator I've seen is if somebody's got a contract to sell the contract before they actually take title to the property.
Okay.
That's a speculator. But somebody who sells the property the next day after they bought it, if the price goes up, you can make an argument that, hey, I invested. Doesn't mean I have to hold it for a long time. There's no holding period. People get that confused. They think that you have to hold it a certain amount of time to demonstrate that you're an investor. No, you have to have the intention of being an investor. You have to act like an investor, look like an investor, and do what an investor would do. And many investors would sell their property if they got a good price.
That's very interesting that you bring that up. Here's a real life example. We have we bought a group of lots in Florida, fully intention to build on them, and something happened to the area, and we were offered over double within 3 weeks of buying the property. That would be an honest case of.
Yeah.
Holy mackerel, you know, it wasn't my intention, but I've changed my mind. And that's allowable, is that correct?
Yes, as long as your intention overall was to invest.
Okay.
Because that is the true purpose. And 99% of the case law in 1031 revolves around what was your intention. So not how long do you hold it, it's what was your intention. Now, for example, on the flip side, there was a developer in a case who had converted an apartment building to condominium, and it was a bad real estate market, and he had it advertised as for sale, for rent, for purchase, anything, everything and anything. So he's either renting the units or selling them, he was marketing heavily from day one, and the court said, you know, your intention was to get money from these properties, but not to necessarily hold them as an investor. He was so, all over the map with what his intention was. It was unclear, and so they assumed that he did not have an intention to be an investor. He was looking to flip.
Okay.
So you have to be careful, and it goes by your facts. And if you can document that you were, you know, held on your books as an investment and your intentions were that way, then the length of time. He owned those properties 11 years. That's a piece of the story I left off, which I apologize. So the fact that he owned it for 11 years didn't help him.
Wow.
Yeah. Your intentions were wrong.
Even his intentions 11 years into it couldn't be to appear as a flipper. Amazing.
Well, because he was advertising it from before he had even made the conversion.
I see. Okay.
That's what hung them.
Okay.
And then we've had people that, other cases that, you know, the lady of the house decided to decorate the replacement property. So it was clear that her intention was to move in because she picked her favorite colors.
Exactly. Okay.
Now, had she just been neutral about it and done beige, waited a week or two or a month or a year, there's no holding period, and then converted the use to personal use, she might have been okay.
Interesting. Some investors have questions that, you know, about when they're doing these transactions. Now, are you allowed to borrow money on the replacement property directly after you close?
Yes.
That's allowed. Okay.
Must be a separate transaction the
Correct.
Next day.
Okay. Are you allowed to borrow money on the relinquished property just prior to selling?
Not a good idea, according to the case law. Shows that you don't want to be an investor. You just want to cash out.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, we do have investments where the sponsors will allow for cash out refis after you purchase the investment. And those are some interesting choices for some of your sophisticated investors, and I won't take up your time now, but we do have a host of replacement property choices for investors that, you know, get into trouble. And those are on our site in the plan section, my1031place.com plan button, because investors need to know that there are safety nets out there so that they're not reluctant to exchange, and then, you know, make their own choices.
Is there any problem with paying off mortgages quickly? Let's say that you had to borrow money to avoid boot. Are you allowed to pay those mortgages off quickly?
Yeah. That, holding the mortgage any length of time is not, a factor.
Okay. It's interesting. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I was going to say, but using the mortgages creatively in the exchange process is great because with today's rates, it's almost like a zero interest mortgage. They're so low. So it's way better to borrow than pay tax, and if you need to borrow to get cash out of property after you've reinvested, it's a great use of the property and the lending that's available now because, the taxes are now indexed to people's income, and it goes from 30 to 47% in New York City. 30 to 47% of your gain, depending on where you live and how much you make, goes back to the government. I mean, that's having a partner.
Yeah, for sure. I'm real familiar with that, unfortunately.
Well, I'm sorry to bring it up, but there is a solution. It's the only tax break left in America, and the IRS does not have a good public relations department, so they don't promote it well.
Under what circumstances is it allowed for you to move into a replacement property as a residence?
Well, it has to be your intention to invest. Now, if your intention changes after the exchange is reported on your return, I don't know that there's any restriction against that. But you do need to have the intention to invest initially. And that's why these things have to get planned. So long-term, let's say you wanted to exchange a commercial property into a couple of commercial properties or one commercial property and a Palm Springs condo, and you rent out Palm Springs, but, after it's rented for a while, at least a year, you decide to move in and then you retire there. Well, the commercial property you bought as part of the exchange gives you income, and the Palm Springs property is your residence, which you bought with tax-free money. It doesn't get much better than that.
No, but you did say a time frame. So that is that just to prove intent was there?
Yes.
So let's take that. You're in a hot market. You buy that really cool area in Palm Springs that's going up real fast. 2 years after the you still own the property. Let's say for some fantastic reason you have $1 million gain. I would be able to sell that, get $500,000 tax free, and would I be able to exchange the remaining gain for yet again something else?
Yeah.
Okay. So you can sell a residence and also
Yeah, you don't have to buy as much property because you back out the $500,000 gain from the residential exclusion. So that's kind of having your cake and eating it too, because most times you have to reinvest the full value of the selling price to eliminate all the taxes, but here you can back out $500,000.
We kind of touched on it, an improvement exchange. Let's talk about that again, if you don't mind.
Sure. Improvement exchanges are a great use of exchange funds because you're building out property with tax-free money. Now, under the rules, you have to buy same or greater. So you sell $1 million worth, you got to buy another $1 million worth of real estate to replace it with. Well, let's say you can only find something for $750,000, but it needs $250,000 in improvements. What happens is you don't actually take title to that property until the improvements are finished. So you would sell your relinquished open the exchange, the accommodator is sitting with the exchange funds. You find replacement property that you want to improve, and we're doing two of these right now where we take title to the property that you're going to improve. But let me be clear. The accommodator takes title on your behalf and holds the property in the accommodator's name. So you've never taken title to a $750,000 property. The accommodator has, and then the exchange funds are used during the rest of the exchange to build out that property. And once the $250,000 is spent, and now you've got $1 million value because it's $750,000 acquisition, $250,000 improvements, So your $1 million value is deeded from the accommodator back to you, or to you, rather, for the first time. And so now you're really exchanging into a $1 million property because it had to be built out to get to that value.
How are the funds, let's say you got a contractor with a $250,000 contract, how are the funds released to the contractor from the 1031 exchange or the qualified intermediary, I guess? How do you work that?
Well, the monies are in the exchange account, and the contractor is either the client or some third party. Every week, we generally pay bills once a week. They're submitted, once approved by the client, to the exchange firm, and the exchange firm pays the contractor or the third parties and keeps a record of all the disbursements, which are the improvements, so that at the end of the exchange, the ledger will show the acquisition cost and the improvement values, and you can document that you now have a fully improved property, which is worth more than it was than you paid for it.
But it still has to be all done within that 180 days, correct?
It has to be within the 180 days. Yeah, technically, the code says that the improvements have to be affixed to the property within the exchange period. I don't know how all that is understood years later, but that is what the law says.
Okay. A reverse exchange, how common, and what's the mechanics of that?
Interesting. A couple different ways to do it. The easiest way to do it, or back to your first question, how common in this market, more and more, because people find good deals, they want to take advantage of it, but they haven't had a chance to market their property, and they're reasonably certain they're going to be able to sell their property quickly. So they don't have any problem with being stuck with a sale property on the books that they thought they could sell. So the step one is they find a property, they go into contract, they open the exchange. You have to make sure to open your reverse exchange before you close on the purchase property, because the closing statement on the purchase property is when the clock starts running. And a lot of people don't know that, then they call us after they bought something. So I just wanted to emphasize that the exchange begins at the time of closing on the acquisition replacement property. So that starts it. And then the paperwork has to all be executed before you close the purchase property. There are a couple of different ways to structure it, but the easiest way to structure it is before you close the purchase property, the exchange documents are signed, and the deed to the sale property is put into the accommodator's name.
Right.
Now, it's a little hard to understand, or it's a little bit of a misnomer that they call this a reverse exchange, because the first step, really, before you buy the replacement property is that you're deeding your sale property to the accommodator who's going to help you facilitate this. So really, step one is a sale, because you're deeding to the accommodator, and the accommodator signs a note back to you that he owes you the value of this property if he never returned the title.
Okay, so I get it. So I'm relinquishing my...
So it's a sale, then it's a buy. You know, it's real. There is no really reverse exchange in that, but they call it a reverse exchange because technically you're buying first before you've sold your relinquished to a third party, which is what the accommodator lets you do.
Now, in a reverse exchange, then, the 45-day period is not a factor, 180 is. Is that correct?
Yeah, because the 45-day is just going to designate what you want to sell. And if you have written into the exchange agreements the one that you're looking to sell and you've deeded it to, then there's nothing to designate at
right.
that point.
It's okay.
Whatever you, yeah. And some people do designate and deed a number of properties because they're not sure what's going to sell.
Okay.
But that's fine.
We've only got 15 seconds. Go ahead and please give your website again. And
Sure. www.my1031place.com. And a lot of cool functions in the plan section. And to schedule consultations, you go to that section and pick a day and time, and we call you.
And we are involved in 1031 exchange with you right now, and you guys are doing a great job. So, David Greenberger, thank you for taking time, and it's been fun. It's been a great interview.
I thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.